Blue Mars, Cassette 5. Art went to talk to Zake and Nazik that very night, after Nadia had fallen asleep. "So what's the Majari view of all this?" he asked. Zake growled. "Please don't ask stupid questions," he said. "Sunnis are fighting Shiites. Lebanon is devastated. The oil-rich states are hated by the oil-poor states. The North African countries are a metanat. Syria and Iraq hate each other. Iraq and Egypt hate each other. We all hate the Iranians, except for the Shiites. And we all hate Israel, of course, and the Palestinians, too. And even though I am from Egypt, I am actually Bedouin. And we despise the Nile Egyptians. And, in fact, we don't get along well with the Bedouin from Jordan. And everyone hates the Saudis, who are as corrupt as you can get. So when you ask me, what is the Arab view, what can I say to you?" He shook his head darkly. "I guess you say it's a stupid question," Art said. "Sorry. Thinking in constituencies is a bad habit. How about this? What do you think of it?" Nazik laughed. "You could ask him what the rest of the Kahiran Majaris think. He knows them only too well." "Too well," Zake repeated. "Do you think the human rights section will go with them?" Zake frowned. "No doubt we will sign the Constitution. But these rights, I thought there were no Arab democracies still." "What do you mean? There's Palestine, Egypt. Anyway, it's Mars we're concerned with, and here every caravan has been its own state since the very beginning."
"Strong leaders? Hereditary leaders?"
"Not hereditary. Strong leaders, yes. We don't think the new constitution will end that, not anywhere. Why should it? You are a strong leader yourself, yes?"
Art laughed uncomfortably.
"I'm just a messenger." Zake shook his head. "Tell that to Antar. Now there is where you should go, if you want to know what the Kahirans think. He's our king now."
He looked as if he had bit into something sour, and Art said, "So what does he want, do you think?"
"He's Jackie's creature," Zake muttered. "Nothing more."
"I should think that would be a strike against him."
Zake shrugged. "It depends who you talk to," Nazik said. "For the older Muslim immigrants, it's a bad association, because although Jackie is very powerful, she has had more than one consort, and so Antar looks..."
"Compromised," Art suggested, forestalling some other word from the glowering Zake.
"Yes," Nazik said. "But on the other hand, Jackie is powerful. And all of the people now leading the Free Mars Party are in a position to become even more powerful in the new state. And the young Arabs like that. They're more native than Arab, I think. It's Mars that matters to them more than Islam. From that point of view, a close association with the zygote ectogenes is a good thing. The ectogenes are seen as the natural leaders of the new Mars, especially Nergal, of course, but with him off to Earth, there's a certain transfer of his influence to Jackie and the rest of her crowd, and thus to Antar."
"I don't like him," Zake said.
Nazik smiled at her husband. "You don't like how many of the native Muslims are following him rather than you. But we are old, Zake. It could be time for retirement."
"I don't see why," Zake objected. "If we're going to live 1,000 years, then what difference does 100 make?"
Art and Nazik laughed at him, and briefly Zake smiled. It was the first time Art had ever seen him smile. In fact, age didn't matter. People wandered around, old or young or somewhere in between, talking and arguing, and it would have been an odd thing for the length of someone's lifetime to become a factor in such discussions. And youth or age wasn't what the native movement was about anyway. If you were born on Mars, your outlook was simply different. areocentric in a way that no Terran could even imagine, not just because of the whole complex of aerial realities they had known from birth, but also because of what they didn't know. Terrans knew just how vast Earth was, while for the Martian-born, that cultural and biological vastness was simply unimaginable. They had seen the screen images, but that wasn't enough to allow them to grasp it. This was one reason Art was glad Nergal had chosen to join the diplomatic mission to Earth. He would learn what they were up against. But most of the natives wouldn't. And the revolution had gone to their heads. Despite their cleverness at the table in working the Constitution toward a form that would privilege them, they were, in some basic sense, naive. They had no idea how unlikely their independence was, nor how possible it was for it to be taken away from them again. And so they were pressing things to the limit, led by Jackie, who floated through the warehouse just as beautiful and enthusiastic as ever, her drive to power concealed behind her love of Mars and her devotion to her grandfather's ideals and her essential goodwill, even innocence. The college girl who wanted passionately for the world to be just. Or so it seemed. But she and her Free Mars colleagues certainly seemed to want to be in control as well. There were 12 million people on Mars now, and 7 million of those had been born there, and almost every single one of these natives could be counted on to support the native political parties, usually Free Mars. "It's dangerous," Charlotte said when Art brought this matter up in the nightly meeting with Nadia. "When you have a country formed out of a lot of groups that don't trust each other, with one a clear majority, then you get what they call census voting, where politicians represent their groups and get their votes, and election results are always just a reflection of population numbers. In that situation, the same thing happens every time, so the majority group has a monopoly on power, and the minorities feel hopeless and eventually rebel. Some of the worst civil wars in history began in those circumstances." "So what can we do?" Nadia asked. "Well, some of it we're doing already, designing structures that spread the power around and diminish the dangers of majoritarianism. Decentralization is important because it creates a lot of small, local majorities. Another strategy is to set up an array of Madisonian checks and balances so that the government's a kind of cat's cradle of competing forces. This is called polyarchy, spreading power around to as many groups as you can." "Maybe we're a bit too polyarchic right now," Art said. "Perhaps. Another tactic is to deprofessionalize governing. You make some big part of the government a public obligation, like jury duty, and then draft ordinary citizens in a lottery to serve for a short time. They get professional staff help, but make the decisions themselves."
"I never heard of that one," Nadia said.
"No. It's been often proposed, but seldom enacted. But I think it's really worth considering. It tends to make power as much a burden as an advantage. You get a letter in the mail, oh no, you're drafted to do 2 years in Congress. It's a drag, but on the other hand, it's a kind of distinction, too. A chance to add something to the public discourse. Citizen government."
"I like that," Nadia said.
"Another method to reduce majoritarianism is voting by some version of the Australian ballot, where voters vote for two or more candidates in ranked fashion, first choice, second choice, third choice. Candidates get some points for being second or third choice, so to win elections they have to appeal outside their own group. It tends to push politicians toward moderation, and in the long run it can create trust among groups where none existed before."
"Interesting," Nadia exclaimed. "Like trusses in a wall."
"Yes." Charlotte mentioned some examples of Terran fractured societies that had healed their rifts by a clever governmental structure. Azania, Cambodia, Armenia. As she described them, Art's heart sank a bit. These had been bloody, bloody lands.
"It seems like political structures can only do so much," he said.
"True," Nadia said. But we don't have all those old hatreds to deal with yet. Here the worst we have is the Reds, and they've been marginalized by the terraforming that's already happened. I bet these methods could be used to pull even them into the process. Clearly she was encouraged by the options Charlotte had described. They were structures, after all. Engineering of an imaginary sort, which nevertheless resembled real engineering. So Nadia was tapping away at her screen, sketching out designs as if working on a building, a small smile tugging the corners of her mouth. "You're happy," Art said. She didn't hear him. But that night in their radio talk with the travelers, she said to Sachs, "It was so nice to find that political science had abstracted something useful in all these years." 8 minutes later, his reply came in. "I never understood why they call it that." Nadia laughed, and the sound filled Art with happiness. Nadia Chernyshevsky, laughing in delight. Suddenly, Art was sure that they were going to pull it off. So he went back to the big table, ready to tackle the next worst problem. That brought him back to Earth again. There were 100 next-worst problems, all small until you actually took them on, at which point they became insoluble. In all the squabbling, it was very hard to see any signs of growing accord. In some areas, in fact, it seemed to be getting worse. The middle points of the Dorsa Brevia document were causing trouble. The more people considered them, the more radical they became. Many around the table clearly believed that Vlad and Marina's eco-economic system, while it had worked for the underground, was not something that should be codified in the Constitution. Some complained because it impinged on local autonomy. Others, because they had more faith in traditional capitalist economics than in any new system. Antar spoke often for this last group, with Jackie sitting right next to him, obviously in support. This, along with his ties to the Arab community, gave his statements a kind of double weight, and people listened. "This new economy that's being proposed," he declared one day at the Table of Tables, repeating his theme, "is a radical and unprecedented intrusion of government into business." Suddenly, Vlad Taneyev stood up. Startled, Antar stopped speaking and looked over. Vlad glared at him. Stooped, massive-headed, shaggy-eyebrowed, Vlad rarely if ever spoke in public. He hadn't said a thing in the Congress so far. Slowly, the greater part of the warehouse went silent, watching him. Art felt a quiver of anticipation. Of all the brilliant minds of the first 100, Vlad was perhaps the most brilliant, and, except for Hiroko, the most enigmatic. Old when they had left Earth, intensely private, Vlad had built the Acheron labs early on and stayed there as much as possible thereafter, living in seclusion with Ursula Cole and Marina Takarova, two more of the great first ones. No one knew anything for certain about the three of them. They were a limit case illustration of the insular nature of other people's relationships. But this, of course, didn't stop gossip. On the contrary, people talked about them all the time, saying that Marina and Ursula were the real couple, that Vlad was a kind of friend or pet, or that Ursula had done most of the work on the longevity treatment and Marina most of the work on eco-economics, or that they were a perfectly balanced equilateral triangle collaborating on all that emerged from Acheron. Or that Vlad was a bigamist of sorts who used two wives as fronts for his work in the separate fields of biology and economics. But no one knew for sure, for none of the three ever said a word about it. Watching him stand there at the table, however, one had to suspect that the theory about him being just a front man was wrong. He was looking around in a fiercely intent, slow glare, capturing them all before he turned his eye again on Antar. "What you said about government and business is absurd," he said coldly. It was a tone of voice that hadn't been heard much at the Congress so far, contemptuous and dismissive. Governments always regulate the kinds of business they allow. Economics is a legal matter, a system of laws. So far, we have been saying in the Martian Underground that as a matter of law, democracy and self-government are the innate rights of every person, and that these rights are not to be suspended when a person goes to work. You, he waved a hand to indicate he did not know Antar's name, do you believe in democracy and self-rule?
Yes, Antar said defensively.
Do you believe in democracy and self-rule as the fundamental values that government ought to encourage?
Yes,
Antar repeated, looking more and more annoyed. Very well. If democracy and self-rule are the fundamentals, then why should people give up these rights when they enter their workplace? In politics, we fight like tigers for freedom, for the right to elect our leaders, for freedom of movement, choice of residence, choice of what work to pursue, control of our lives, in short. And then we wake up in the morning and go to work, and all those rights disappear. We no longer insist on them, and so for most of the day we return to feudalism. That is what capitalism is, a version of feudalism in which capital replaces land and business leaders replace kings, but the hierarchy remains. And so we still hand over our lives' labor, under duress, to feed rulers who do no real work.
Business leaders work, Antar said sharply, and they take the financial risks.
The so-called risk of the capitalist is merely one of the privileges of capital. Management...
Yes, yes, don't interrupt me.
Management is a real thing, a technical matter. But it can be controlled by labor just as well as by capital. Capital itself is simply the useful residue of the work of past laborers, and it could belong to everyone as well as to a few. There is no reason why a tiny nobility should own the capital and everyone else therefore be in service to them. There is no reason they should give us a living wage and take all the rest that we produce.
No, the system called capitalist democracy was not really democratic at all. That is why it was able to turn so quickly into the meta-national system in which democracy grew ever weaker and capitalism ever stronger. In which 1% of the population owned half of the wealth, and 5% of the population owned 95% of the wealth. History has shown which values were real in that system, and the sad thing is that the injustice and suffering caused by it were not at all necessary, in that the technical means have existed since the 18th century to provide the basics of life to all. So, we must... change. It is time. If self-rule is a fundamental value, if simple justice is a value, then they are values everywhere, including in the workplace where we spend so much of our lives. That was what was said in point 4 of the Dorsa Brevia Agreement. It says everyone's work is their own and the worth of it cannot be taken away. It says that the various modes of production belong to those who created them and to the common good of the future generations. It says that the world is something we all steward together. That is what it says. And in our years on Mars, we have developed an economic system that can keep all those promises. That has been our work these last 50 years. In the system we've developed, all economic enterprises are to be small cooperatives owned by their workers and by no one else. They hire their management or manage themselves. Industry guilds and co-op associations will form the larger structures necessary to regulate trade and the market, share capital, and create credit. Antar said scornfully, "These are nothing but ideas. It's utopianism and nothing more."
Not at all. Again, Vlad waved him away. The system is based on models from Terran history, and its various parts have all been tested on both worlds and have succeeded very well. You don't know about this, partly because you're ignorant, and partly because metanationalism itself steadfastly ignored and denied all alternatives to it. But most of our microeconomy has been in successful operation for centuries in the Mondragon region of Spain. The different parts of the macroeconomy have been used in the pseudo-metanat praxis in Switzerland, in India's state of Kerala, in Bhutan, in Bologna, Italy, and in many other places, including the Martian underground itself. These organizations were the precursors to our economy, which will be democratic in a way capitalism never even tried to be. A synthesis of systems. And Vladimir Taneyev was a very great synthesist. It was said that all the components of the longevity treatment had already been there, for instance, and that Vlad and Ursula had simply put them together. Now, in his economic work with Marina, he was claiming to have done the same kind of thing. And although he hadn't mentioned the longevity treatment in this discussion, nevertheless it lay there like the table itself, a big cobbled-together achievement, part of everyone's lives. Art looked around and thought he could see people thinking. Well, he did it once in biology and it worked. Could economics be more difficult? Against this unspoken thought, this unthought feeling, Antar's objections didn't seem like much. Metanational capitalism's track record at this point did little to support it. In the last century, it had precipitated a massive war, chewed up the earth, and torn its societies apart. Why should they not try something new, given that record? Someone from Hiranyagarbha stood and made an objection from the opposite direction, noting that they seemed to be abandoning the gift economy by which the Mars underground had lived. Vlad shook his head impatiently. I believe in the underground economy, I assure you, but it has always been a mixed economy. Pure gift exchange coexisted with a monetary exchange in which neoclassical market rationality, that is to say the profit mechanism, was bracketed and contained by society to direct it to serve higher values, such as justice and freedom. Economic rationality is simply not the highest value. It is a tool to calculate costs and benefits, only one part of a larger equation concerning human welfare. The larger equation is called a mixed economy, and that is what we are constructing here. We are proposing a complex system with public and private spheres of economic activity. It may be that we ask people to give throughout their lives about a year of their work to the public good, as in Switzerland's national service. That labor pool, plus taxes on private co-ops for use of the land and its resources, will enable us to guarantee the so-called social rights we have been discussing. Housing, healthcare, food, education. Things that should not be at the mercy of market rationality. Because la salute non si paga, as the Italian workers used to say. Health is not for sale. This was especially important to Vlad, Art could see. Which made sense, for in the metanational order, health most certainly had been for sale, not only medical care and food and housing, but preeminently the longevity treatment itself, which so far had been going only to those who could afford it. Vlad's greatest invention, in other words, had become the property of the privileged, the ultimate class distinction, long life or early death. A physicalization of class that almost resembled divergent species. No wonder he was angry. No wonder he had turned all his efforts to devising an economic system that would transform the longevity treatment from a catastrophic possession to a blessing available to all. So nothing will be left to the market, Antar said. No, 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 Vlad said, waving at Antar more irritably than ever. The market will always exist. It is the mechanism by which things and services are exchanged. Competition to provide the best product at the best price. This is inevitable and healthy. But on Mars, it will be directed by society in a more active way. There will be not-for-profit status to vital life support matters, and then the freest part of the market will be directed away from the basics of existence toward non-essentials, where venture enterprises can be undertaken by worker-owned co-ops who will be free to try what they like. When the basics are secured, and when the workers own their own businesses, why not? It is the process of creation we are talking about. Jackie, looking annoyed at Vlad's dismissals of Antar, and perhaps intending to divert the old man or trip him up, said, "What about the ecological aspects of this economy that you used to emphasize?" "They are fundamental," Vlad said. Point 3 of Dorsa Brevia states that the land, air, and water of Mars belong to no one, that we are the stewards of it for all the future generations. This stewardship will be everyone's responsibility, but in case of conflicts, we propose strong environmental courts, perhaps as part of the Constitutional Court, which will estimate the real and complete environmental costs of economic activities and help to coordinate plans that impact the environment. "But this is simply a planned economy," Antar cried. "Economies are plans. Capitalism planned just as much as this, and metanationalism tried to plan everything. No, an economy is a plan." Antar, frustrated and angry, said, "It's simply socialism returned." Vlad shrugged. "Mars is a new totality. Names from earlier totalities are deceptive. They become little more than theological terms. There are elements one could call socialist in this system, of course. How else remove injustice from economy? But private enterprises will be owned by their workers rather than being nationalized, and this is not socialism, at least not socialism as it was usually attempted on Earth. And all the co-ops are businesses, small democracies devoted to some work or other, all needing capital. There will be a market. There will be capital. But in our system, workers will hire capital rather than the other way around. It's more democratic that way, more just. Understand me. We have tried to evaluate each feature of this economy by how well it aids us to reach the goals of more justice and more freedom. And justice and freedom do not contradict each other as much as has been claimed, because freedom in an unjust system is no freedom at all. They both emerge together, and so it is not so impossible, really. It is only a matter of enacting a better system by combining elements that have been tested and shown to work. This is the moment for that. We have been preparing for this opportunity for 70 years, and now that the chance has come, I see no reason to back off just because someone is afraid of some old words. If you have any specific suggestions for improvements, we'll be happy to hear them." He stared long and hard at Antar, but Antar did not speak. He had no specific suggestions. The room was filled with a charged silence. It was the first and only time in the Congress that one of the Issei had stood up and trounced one of the Nisei in public debate. Most of the Issei liked to take a more subtle line, but now one of the ancient radicals had gotten mad and risen up to smite one of the neoconservative young power-mongers, who now looked like they were advocating a new version of an old hierarchy for purposes of their own, a thought which was conveyed very well indeed by Vlad's long look across the table at Antar, full of disgust at his reactionary selfishness, his cowardice in the face of change. Vlad sat down. Antar was dismissed. But they still argued. Conflict, meta-conflict, details, fundamentals. Everything was on the table, including a magnesium kitchen sink that someone had placed on one segment of the table of tables some 3 weeks into the process. And really, the delegates in the warehouse were only the tip of the iceberg, the most visible part of a gigantic two-world debate. Live transmission of every minute of the conference was available everywhere on Mars and in most places on Earth, and although the actual real-time tape had a certain documentary tediousness to it, Mangalavid concocted a daily highlights film that was shown during the time slip every night and sent to Earth for very wide distribution. It became the greatest show on Earth, as one American program rather oddly dubbed it. "Maybe people are tired of the same old crap on TV," Art said to Nadia one night as they watched a brief, weirdly distorted account of the day's negotiations on American TV. "Or in the world." "Yeah, true. They want something else to think about." "Or else they're thinking about what they might do," Nadia suggested. "So that we're a small-scale model. Easier to understand."
"Maybe so."
In any case, the two worlds watched, and the Congress became, along with everything else that it was, a daily soap opera. A soap opera which, however, held an extra attraction for its viewers somehow, as if in some strange way it held the very key to their lives. And perhaps as a result, thousands of spectators did more than watch. Comments and suggestions were pouring in, and though it seemed unlikely to most people on Pavonis that something mailed in would contain a startling truth they hadn't thought of, still all messages were read by groups of volunteers in Sheffield and South Fossa who passed some proposals up to the table. Some people even advocated including all these suggestions in the final constitution. They objected to a statist legal document. They wanted it to be a larger thing, a collaborative, philosophical, or even spiritual statement expressing their values, goals, dreams, reflections. "That's not a constitution," Nadia objected. "That's a culture. We're not the damn library here." But included or not, long communiques continued to come in from the tents and canyons and the drowned coastlines of Earth, signed by individuals, committees, entire town populations. Discussions in the warehouse were just as wide-ranging as in the mail. A Chinese delegate approached Art and spoke in Mandarin to him, and when he paused for a while, his AI began to speak. "To tell the truth, I've begun to doubt that you've sufficiently consulted Adam Smith's important book, Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations." "You may be right," Art said, and referred the man to Charlotte. Many people in the warehouse were speaking languages other than English and relying on translation AIs to communicate with the rest. At any given moment, there were conversations in a dozen different languages, and AI translators were heavily used. Art still found them a little distracting. He wished it were possible to know all these languages, even though the latest generations of AI translators were really pretty good. Voices well modulated, vocabularies large and accurate, grammar excellent, phrasing almost free of the errors that had made earlier translation programs such a great party game. The new ones had gotten so good that it seemed possible that the English language dominance that had created an almost monoglot Martian culture might begin to recede. The Issei had, of course, brought all languages with them, but English had been their lingua franca. The Nisei had therefore used English to communicate among themselves, while their primary languages were used only to speak to their parents, and so, for a while, English had become the natives' native tongue. But now with the new AIs and a continuing stream of new immigrants speaking the full array of Terran languages, it looked like things might broaden back out again as new Nisei stayed with their primary languages and used AIs as their lingua franca instead of English. This linguistic matter illustrated to Art a complexity in the native population that he hadn't noticed before. Some natives were Yonsei, fourth generation or younger, and very definitely children of Mars. But other natives the very same age were the Nisei children of recent Issei immigrants, tending to have closer ties with the Terran cultures they had come from, with all the conservatism that implied. so that there were new native conservatives and old settler family native radicals, one might say. And this split only occasionally correlated with ethnicity or nationality when these still mattered to them at all. One night Art was talking with a couple of them, one a global government advocate, the other an anarchist backing all local autonomy proposals, and he asked them about their origins. The globalist's father was half Japanese, a quarter Irish, and a quarter Tanzanian. Her mother had a Greek mother and a father with parents Colombian and Australian. The anarchist had a Nigerian father and a mother who was from Hawaii and thus had a mixed ancestry of Filipino, Japanese, Polynesian, and Portuguese. Art stared at them. If one were to think in terms of ethnic voting blocks, how would one categorize these people? One couldn't. They were Martian natives. Nisei, Sansei, Yonsei, whatever generation, they had been formed in large part by their Martian experience, aerial-formed just as Hiroko had always foretold. Many had married within their own national or ethnic background, but many more hadn't. And no matter what their ancestry, their political opinions tended to reflect not that background, just what would the Greco-Colombian-Australian position be, Art wondered, but their own experience. This itself had been quite varied. Some had grown up in the underground, others had been born in the UN-controlled big cities, and only come to an awareness of the underground later in life, or even at the moment of the revolution itself. These differences tended to affect them much more than where their Terran ancestors had happened to live. Art nodded as the natives explained these things to him in the long kava-buzzed parties running deep into the night. People at these parties were in increasingly high spirits as the Congress was, they felt, going well. They didn't take the debates among the Issei very seriously. They were confident that their core beliefs would prevail. Mars would be independent, it would be run by Martians. What Earth wanted didn't matter. Beyond that, it was detail. Thus, they went about their work in the committees without much attention paid to the philosophical arguments around the table of tables. "The old dogs keep growling," said one message on the big message board. This seemed to express a general native opinion. And the work in the committees went on. The big message board was a pretty good indicator of the mood of the Congress. Art read it the way he read fortune cookies, and indeed one day there was one message that said, "You like Chinese food." Usually the messages were more political than that. Often they were things said in the previous days of the conference. No tent is an island. If you can't afford housing, then the right to vote is a bad joke. Keep your distance, don't change speed, don't run into anything. La salute non si paga. Then there were things that hadn't been said. Do unto others. The reds have green roots. The greatest show on earth. No kings, no presidents. Big man hates politics. However, we are the little red people. So Art was no longer surprised when he was approached by people who spoke in Arabic or Hindi or some language he didn't recognize, then looked him in the eye while their AI spoke in English with an accent from the BBC or Middle America or the New Delhi Civil Service, expressing some kind of unpredictable political sentiment. It was encouraging, really, not the translation AIs, which were just another kind of distancing, less extreme than teleparticipation, but still not quite talking face to face, but the political melange. The impossibility of block voting or of even thinking in the normal constituencies. It was a strange congregation, really, but it went on and eventually everyone got used to it. It took on that always-already quality that extended events often gain over their duration. But once, very late at night, after a long, bizarre translated conversation in which the AI on the wrist of the young woman he was talking to spoke in rhymed couplets, and he never knew what language she was speaking to start with, Art wandered back through the warehouse toward his office suite around the table of tables, where work was still going even though it was after the time slip, and he stopped to say hi to one group. And then, momentum lost, slumped back against a side wall, half-watching, half-drowsing, his kava-java buzz nearly overwhelmed by exhaustion. And the strangeness came back all at once. It was a kind of hypnagogic vision. There were shadows in the corners, innumerable flickering shadows, and eyes in the shadows. Shapes like insubstantial bodies, all the dead, it suddenly seemed, and all the unborn, all there in the warehouse with them, to witness this moment. As if history were a tapestry, and the Congress the loom where everything was coming together, the present moment with its miraculous there-ness, its potential right in their own atoms, their own voices. Looking back at the past, able to see it all, a single, long-braided tapestry of events. Looking forward at the future, able to see none of it, though presumably it branched out in an explosion of threads of potentiality and could become anything. They were two different kinds of unreachable immensity, and all of them traveling together from the one into the other through that great loom, the present, the now. Now was their chance, for all of them together in this present. The ghosts could watch, from before and after, but this was the moment when what wisdom they could muster had to be woven together to be passed on to all the future generations. They could do anything. That, however, was part of what made it difficult to bring the Congress to a close. Infinite possibility was going to collapse in the act of choosing to the single world line of history, the future becoming the past. There was something disappointing in this passage through the loom, this so sudden diminution from infinity to one, the collapse from potentiality to reality, which was the action of time itself. The potential was so delicious. The way they could have, potentially, all the best parts of all good governments of all time combined magically into some superb, as yet unseen synthesis, or throw all that aside and finally strike a new path to the heart of just government. To go from that to the mundane problematic of the Constitution as written was an inevitable letdown, and instinctively people put it off.
This ends side one of cassette 5. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.